Voices from the Valley on Park Radio. Where the lives of the people that call the Bow Valley home come to life.
Hi, and welcome to Voices from the Valley. I'm Alan Buckingham. This week, we are featuring photographer John Marriott. Joining me to talk about John Marriott is Canmore-based writer Lynn Martell. Hi, Lynn, and thanks for joining me today.
Hey, Alan, how's it going?
Good. So, John Marriott, tell me about him.
Well, John Marriott is very much a wildlife photographer and natural landscape photographer as well. But I think he's best known for wildlife, and that's the work he does really, really well. And he lives in Canmore. He's been in the Bow Valley for a good 15 years or so. And the Canadian Rockies and the Bow Valley are a really, really interesting place because people who live here and decide to make their home here and create their own profession, there's a lot of very self-motivated people who choose to be here, and it's a choice. Sometimes there's a bit of luck involved, you know, in that initial visit, but for those of us who choose to stay, it's a conscious choice. And John actually had a bit of luck at the beginning in choosing to be here, but in why he ended up here, but from that point on, it was very, very much a choice. And once you're living here, too, you know, there's not a huge variety of jobs to choose from. But then for people who are self-motivated and have a passion, you can create your own profession. So John's one of those people.
Totally. And he's a photographer. How did he get into photography?
You know, some people just have a natural calling. And John, you know, probably from the time that his fingers could actually work a shutter, he was out there snapping photos. And it's hilarious, actually, that he was so little when he took his first couple of photos of wildlife.
When I was 6 or 7 years old, my parents gave me a Kodak Instamatic camera, and we did a trip to the Canadian Rockies. And I remember going by Moose Lake and Mount Robson Provincial Park and seeing a moose out there and actually taking pictures, getting out on the side of the road and taking pictures with my little camera, and then doing the same thing for a couple of bears along the Icefields Parkway, and then getting home, and I actually still have the little photo album that I created from it. And there's these little teeny specks way in the distance that you can see, there's a moose, there's a bear. After that, the next sort of real outdoor experience was when I was 10 or 11, I used to build wildlife photography blinds out near our cabin on Shuswap Lake, and I would build them out of whatever. I would take sticks and stones and anything and create this sort of hut-like thing, and I would go and sit in it in the dark still, pre-dawn, so 4 a.m. in the morning, and sit there and wait for something to walk by. And it generally at that time I was looking for deer, and I had my little Kodak Instamatic and stuff, and never ever worked. I never saw a thing from it.
And what brought John to the Rockies? You mentioned there was a bit of luck in there.
Oh, that's hilarious. He actually had a job lined up, and it fell through.
When I was 21, I actually came to the Rockies on a 3-day vacation. I was just in the process of graduating from UBC, from the University of British Columbia, with a degree in forestry, specializing in wildlife management and parks and recreation. And I had lined up a job as an assistant recreational forester in Merritt, British Columbia. So I decided, okay, I'll whiz out to the Rockies for a quick little 3-day trip. While I was out here on the Sunday, I phoned home to tell my dad I was on my way home. And he said, I've got some bad news for you, John. The Forest Service called from Merritt on Friday just after you left, and the job funding fell through. And I was really disappointed. And he said, well, I'll tell you what, I'll put $500 in your bank account. Why don't you see if you can find a job there in Banff and, you know, see if you want to stay there for the summer. And so I stuck around for a week, ended up finding a job at the Luxton Museum, and the rest is history. I actually worked 2 jobs my first summer in Banff. I worked at the Luxton Museum, taking cash for the tourists coming in to tour around the museum, and I worked at the Banff Springs Hotel in the mini golf. And then second year in Banff, I went down, had the same job at the Luxton Museum, went down and volunteered with Parks Canada, which is who I really wanted to work for at the time, and the guy that I went in and volunteered for was a guy called Jeff Waugh, and he was in charge of the park's interpretation in Banff National Park. And he phoned me back 3 hours after I went in and had my volunteer interview with him and said, how'd you like a real job instead? And so, of course, I took it and started working for Parks and worked for them for the next 5 years until the end of 1995. The first couple of years, I was pretty much a naturalist, so park interpreter. So I would do slideshows at the campgrounds, did a bit of guided hikes. I wrote an article for the Craggan Canyon, a weekly article for them. just sort of that sort of thing. So a lot of writing, a lot of speaking, and a bit of guided hiking and stuff. Next few years I moved on, and I actually ended up working in the computer department and doing training, computer training, and also developing the first 8 websites for Parks Canada and Western Canada. I was the original person who developed those, so that was kind of neat to be involved on that ground level like that. It actually helped my photography career, because when I started photography in 1996, one of the first things I did was build my own website. And for the first 4 or 5 years, I was one of the few nature photographers in Canada that had their own website. So that was how I was able to sort of create a niche that way and get into photography, even though I was competing against people that were a lot more established.
And how did he end up starting a career in photography? I'm guessing he didn't just start out that way.
Creative pursuits like that, it's your passion. So everybody goes out, gets a job that'll sort of pay rent, and that's kind of a secondary thing to the passion. And he went out part-time. So John spent his days off out there with his camera and taking photos of wildlife, or trying to, going to look for them at least.
So from 1996 to 2000, 96 was when I sold my first image, the very first one. I started big. I sold a full-page spread to Canadian Geographic, to the magazine. So that was my first sale ever. It was January 1996. I started my business just after that. And for the first 4 years, I was working part-time in other jobs. So I'd left Parks Canada. I worked in a web startup company with 3 other guys from the Bow Valley. And I also taught computers for a company called GetSmart here in Canmore. And so I was photographing that whole time. And then in 2000, I made the decision to plunge in full time. I figured I was making enough money that I'd be able to make it. And I was just barely right. My first year, I scraped by, really, literally scraped by. There were 2 months where I lived entirely on my credit card. 2 different months where I had my parents had to pay my rent for me, had to borrow money from them and pay them back. So it was really, really scraping by. There were often times where I was deciding between a tank of gas or a couple rolls of film or that kind of thing.
Now, John's taken a bazillion photographs. Does he remember what the first one was that really got him excited?
You know, that's a really amazing thing, that somebody could take that many photographs in their lifetime and remember specific ones.
First one I took that I was totally excited about is actually a different one than the first one that started making me money. The first one I was totally excited about, I was still working for Parks. This was 1995, so I'd had my camera gear for about a year. And I was up on the Quarry Pass Trail photographed this huge bighorn ram with a beautiful blue sky in behind it. And he was perched up on this ledge, and it looked just fantastic. And I got back, and I was super excited, and I went into the Parks Interpretive Center there, the visitor center, and went downstairs to the big light boxes that they have there for looking at slides, and slapped it down there, and I brought in everybody, said, "You gotta come look at these photos and stuff." Well, I never made a cent off any of those photos, and I actually ended up about 5 years later throwing them all out because they weren't good enough. But at that same time period, I took 2 photos in 1995 that, while I didn't sell them for a couple of years, ended up, even still to this day, are 2 of my best-selling photos. One is of a black bear in dandelions, eating dandelions on the side of the road right off the Trans-Canada Highway as you head towards Salmon Arm, as I was heading home to visit my parents one spring. And the other one is of a bull elk in the snow, in a snowstorm at Lake Minnewanka. Okay. So those are both from 1995, and they're actually the only 2 photos I still have from 1995.
And so when did John move to doing photography full-time?
He decided in around 2000 that, okay, so I'm going to do it and bite the bullet and jump into it full-time.
The very first year full-time was a real, like I said, I just barely scraped by. And so I decided I had to do something to try and get into the next level in photography, otherwise I wasn't going to make it. And so in 2001, I made the decision that, I've got to do some kind of product. And looked at books briefly, decided, you know, I'm not well known enough to do a book at this point. Looked at postcards. Most of the stores said, you know, it's a pretty hard thing to make a living at, trying to do postcards. And what I ended up settling on was greeting cards. Because stores said, you know what, there could be an opening. And a couple of the photographers I talked to that had done greeting cards elsewhere said, yeah, I make pretty decent money at it. So I did a full greeting card project and did 72,000 greeting cards in 2001. And launched my Wilderness Moments greeting cards line, and it's done really well over the years. I've now, at this point, 8 years later, sold more than 150,000 greeting cards.
And now John has books as well, right?
Yeah, he's got several books out now, and two new ones came out this summer. And he's like I said, he's a smart guy and does some research, sees what's out there, and how can I tweak this or tweak that to make my product stand out or make it a little different, or what do the customers want? What kind of product that I can I create that customers are going to be happy to say, hey, oh, right on, this is exactly what we need and we'll take home.
I just put out two more books, both coffee table books in the Canadian Rockies.
Why two at the same time?
I wanted to hit up two markets at the same time. I had had people looking at my first two coffee table books and it had sort of feedback from store owners saying, you know, you do get people looking at them that love them, but don't take them for some reason. So I sort of suspected, you know what, it's probably because of these weight restrictions and size restrictions they have on planes now. So I thought, well, what I'll do is I'll put out a big version of a Canadian Rockies book, and I'll put out a little mini travel version that's easier for people to take away. And the books have only been out 4 weeks, and already the little version is obviously a great idea because it's already sold double what the big one has sold, and it's also outselling my two other books already. So obviously hit a smart idea there. I don't know if that was luck or I just decided to try it, and it's doing well so far.
We've got to take a bit of a break here, but when we get back, we'll hear some more about wildlife photographer John Marriott.
Voices from the Valley will be right back. Welcome back to Voices from the Valley.
Hi, and welcome back to Voices from the Valley. I'm Alan Buckingham. This week, I'm joined by Lynn Martell, and we're talking about photographer John Marriott. So now, Lynn, I know it's bad to make assumptions, but I'm assuming that John works in digital photography.
Well, you've assumed right, but that's an interesting thing. And I know a lot of photographers and talked to a lot of people over through the years. And for all of them, you know, there was that moment where they had to keep up with technology and move to digital. And I don't know any full-time photographers now who are out there and not working with a digital camera, but for every last one of them, it was a traumatic moment.
I made the switch to digital 4 years ago. Bought my first camera with a Canon 5D, which is a full-frame camera. And I've always leaned more towards the full-frame because I like to be able to do scenics and wildlife with the same camera if I can. I've always owned two digital cameras for the last 3 years. So right now I have a Canon 5D II that I use for landscapes and a 1D Mark III that I use for wildlife. Initially, I held back a little bit. I was pretty late for a photographer to switch over, especially a full-time photographer. Initially, I had some hesitation, but I would say within a week, I was, oh, wow, this is amazing. I'm so glad I switched. And I kept my film camera for about a year and actually took it on trips with me and stuff, thinking, oh, I'll use it. Never ever used it again. Mm-hmm. So literally the first day I started using the digital camera, that was it for film. Never used it again. Mm-hmm. In fact, I finally threw out just about 3 months ago, threw out the extra 50 rolls of film I still had sitting in my fridge that I kept holding on to.
So when John goes out to shoot wildlife, take pictures of wildlife, where does he go? How does he do that?
Yeah, self-motivated. People who are self-employed have their own little routines and their own, and he likes to explore by nature. So, and he doesn't want to be around the crowds. So yeah, John's got his routines, and he tells me a whole bunch of secret little places that he'll go to that he's been successful in those places before, and he goes back to, and he's always looking for new ones.
I literally have spots all over the Rockies, Jasper, Banff, Kananaskis, but also I have all kinds of secret spots in BC and little logging roads that I go to and stuff that no other photographers go to that I've never seen other people on, other than the odd, you know, hunter or something.
And now, does John ever worry about the impact he could have on the animals that he's out there taking pictures of?
You know, the amount of time that he has spent in the wilderness photographing animals and learning their history through time afterwards too. Yeah, you can't help but have a relationship, and he definitely thinks about that impact, and not just the impact he's having, he thinks about the impact other people are having too, and his role and his responsibility in those situations.
Well, there's a couple of things that I do. One, you won't often find me at sort of the big wildlife events. So when elk are running up in Jasper and there's 30 photographers standing on the side of the road, I'm not one of them. I'll be off somewhere else trying to find elk where there's nobody else. I like to be in places where there's few other photographers. There's a couple places I do go where there's lots of photographers, but I like to have sort of a, I don't like that big impact that you have of having a big group there following an animal around, and I don't think the animals necessarily act naturally either. The other thing, that a couple other things that I do, I go out very early in the morning or very late in the evening, so that if there is a bear by the side of the road, I can photograph it. I'll stay in my vehicle, I'll use the vehicle as a blind, and just to minimize the impact on the bear. If you start walking around with the bear, then you never know, the next person might be coming along and feeding it a loaf of bread or something. So I'll do that, and I usually try and minimize, especially if it's a bear, for instance, on the Bow Valley Parkway or something like that, I'll try and minimize the time that I spend with the animal. So it'll be a couple hours in the morning, a couple hours in the evening, just so it's not getting too used to vehicles and stuff. And if there's any kind of bear jam that starts, I usually leave. Not always. If it's, you know, a remarkable situation, for instance, this past year on the Edgefields Parkway, there was a grizzly with two cubs of the year, and it's very rare to see that near a road, and this is a bear that I photographed in the past, and I know she's a very gentle bear, and she lives by roads for a reason. There's good food beside the Edgefields Parkway, and she's able to deal with people. She's not that concerned by them. So I stayed up there, and, you know, sometimes the bear jam's got as many as five or six vehicles early in the morning or late in the evening. And I would stay there until the bear aware people started showing up and the wardens started showing up. And then I'd, you know, hand off to them literally and say, you know, okay, I'm heading out of here, guys, so I'm not in your hair anymore. You know, do your job and let them go about doing, you know, clearing the bear jams and making sure the bears don't get in any trouble. I've yelled and screamed at people for getting too close to bears, and I've a very, very dangerous situation twice, where it hasn't turned out to be dangerous, but it could have potentially been. Once on the Maligne Lake Road in Jasper National Park, was driving by a bear jam, and as I was driving by, I watched a lady throw an entire loaf of bread down the hill to a mother black bear with two cubs. I stopped in the middle of the road, slammed my horn, jumped out with my bear spray and ran down right at the bear. So I just completely ignored it because there was like 30 people there. And I just raced down the hill right away with the bear spray, and the bear is scattered. And I grabbed the loaf of bread and I raced back up the hill again. So before she had gotten a chance, she was about 2 feet away from it when I started running down the hill, before she got a chance to get to it. And then I went up, and before I even got back up the hill, there were already three other tourists screaming at this lady. So I just got back in my car and drove away. So it was pretty obvious. I think she got the message pretty quickly.
John's been out there for years taking photographs of animals, and it's amazing, you know, he can recognize animals that he sees again and again. He can recognize an animal he hasn't seen for a year and know it's the exact same animal.
One of the sad things about being a wildlife photographer is because you're out there all the time, you get to know all these animals, in particular animals that live near roadsides because they're easier to access. Mm-hmm. I mean, I do definitely do trips into the wilderness and into the backcountry looking for wildlife. There are certain things that I go for, but a lot of the wildlife is just simply easier to access by roads, and those are also the same animals that are much more susceptible to being killed on the roadways or being killed by a train. And unfortunately, just about every favorite bear or wolf I've had since I started photographing in 1994 has ended up dead at some point. Thankfully, not all of them. There's certain ones that lived a really long time. Blondie, a grizzly bear, lived almost 20 years before she was finally hit on a road. So she put out all kinds of cubs that have done really well. And, you know, she was a really good bear. But you do run that risk. I mean, that's all the bears that I fall in love with. Just because of where they live, because of that habitat that they like, because they are used to people. It's sort of this debate I have internally sometimes, and I always sort of figure that the good that I'm doing with my wildlife photography, getting the images out there, balances out the bad that I'm doing by being near bears and habituating them to some degree. I do think there is a bit of a difference, though. Bears that habituate to a roadside, it's not necessarily a bad thing. As long as people are driving the speed limit and stuff, there is a lot of good food there. That's why bears come by roadsides. And it's also why females with cubs come by there, because it's great food and they don't have to worry about the big old male bears that aren't going to come near the roads. So it's one of the reasons you see a lot of cubs, mothers with cubs near roads. It's not necessarily, it's just they tolerate the people. They put up with us so that they can get food and not be in danger from some of the bigger old male bears.
And there's a fair bit of kind of animal nature study going on, and he's had some really really meaningful moments, developing kind of a weird, you know, it's a relationship at a distance, but with the animals. And some of them, well, I mean, they just make you cry.
Belinda, yeah. One of my saddest wildlife endings for sure, but two glorious years before that, 2004 or 2005, Delinda first moved to the Bow Valley, they think, and joined Nanook, which was a male wolf. It was the lone remaining wolf from the Bow Valley pack that had been up to as many as 12 in the late 90s and early 2000s. And Nanook was the final one left. The rest had all been killed on the road or by trains. And he was finally joined by Delinda, this new wolf that moved in 2004, 2005. They had the first litter of four pups the spring after. Two of those survived. And then in 2007, they had six more pups, of which, is that 2008? One of those years, 2007 or 2008, they had six more pups, and all of them survived. So the pack went all the way up to 10 animals again and was doing phenomenally well. And then, unfortunately, in August of 2008, I got a phone call from the wardens, and they knew that from my picture on the back of the Banff bus that I'd photographed Delinda before, and they asked me, they said, we've got a wolf in here that was hit in the Trans-Canada last night. Can you come in and ID it? And so I went in with Günter Block, who's an independent wolf researcher, probably the single most knowledgeable person about wolves in the Bow Valley, and him and I went in, and right away it was obvious that it was Delinda, that it was the alpha female of the Bow Valley pack. And probably the saddest wildlife moment I've ever had, just sitting there looking at her, because she's such a beautiful wolf, and she was so perfect for the Bow Valley pack, because she had a perfect disposition. She was a wild wolf, and yet she was able to, for the most part, for those 4 years, work near roads and railways and so on, and work near people, and raise all these pups up successfully, which is very difficult to do with roads and railways everywhere. Teach them to use the railway without getting hit by trains, teach them to use the roads without getting hit in general, and then near the end, one tiny little mistake, and she was hit on the Trans-Canada Highway by getting under a little hole in the fence. And just very unfortunate incident. And from that point onwards, just the whole pack went into decline. As soon as Mum was gone, less than a week later, another of the pups was hit on the Trans-Canada. Another couple months later, they lost another pup. And then this last year, they've lost several more. And so they're down to four or five wolves right now, from a high of 10 at one point, and all just within a year of her death. So it's been very tough for me, because I had two sort of great years, 2007 and winter of 2008, of getting to photograph her in the pack. And she was just a fantastic wolf to photograph. There were several times where, either on foot or off my from the vehicle, I was literally right beside her. And she would just do her thing, either be hunting or be waiting for other members of the pack or looking after her pups or whatever. She was just a fantastic wolf, so, and beautiful, absolutely beautiful.
Wow, it's quite a life being a wildlife photographer. Thanks, Lynn, for coming by and sharing a little bit of what that's like in John Marriott's story with us today.
Oh, my pleasure, Alan. Always happy to do it. There's so many neat people in our valley.
To find out more about interesting people like John Marriott, check out Lynn Martell's book, Expedition to the Edge. It's available at The Bear and the Butterfly at 214 Banff Avenue. And you can also check out her website, lynnmartell.ca. Voices from the Valley can be heard each week at this time on Park Radio. You can also download a podcast of the show by heading to friendsofbanff.com and clicking the podcast link. Thanks for listening, and remember to tune in next week for more Voices from the Valley.
Voices from the Valley. Only on Park Radio 101.1 FM.